FlightBridge Ed Live and online courses are even better now that they're powered by iSimulate. With Reality 360 providing powerful monitor and ventilator simulations, students don't have to imagine anymore, they can engage. Now, with the brand new CTGI module, students can train with highly advanced and realistic fetal heart rate simulations. Just another example of FlightBridge Ed and iSimulate being your partner in discovery. Check out iSimulate.com for more information.
The content of this podcast is based on medical fact and evidence-based practice from credible authoritative sources, but is not a substitute for your institution's policies, procedures, common sense, or good judgment. The views and opinions are those of Eric Bauer and FlightBridge Ed in their entirety.
Hey everybody, welcome to the FlightBridge Ed podcast. Mike Verkest along with Eric Bauer and Dr. Demetrius Yiannopoulos out of Minnesota, and we are going to talk ECMO.
Yeah, very excited about this podcast. I've been trying to meet up with Dr. Yiannopoulos for a while now, and he's a very busy man. Very excited to have you, sir.
Well, it's a pleasure being here with you guys. Thank you for the invitation, and I'm happy to share all the exciting work we're doing here in Minnesota with all your listeners.
Obviously, with our partnership and acquisition by LifeLink 3, and being familiar with the ECMO program from the flight crew side, I wanted to discuss today really your ECMO program and specifically the arrest trial, and just look at it from an analysis standpoint, and just let the listeners know what you're doing up there. I think the results are just absolutely fantastic, and have lots of questions to ask you.
Very well. Well, I can just give you a little historical context of the whole process, because things out of context seem to be much more difficult to grasp. But here in Minneapolis and Paul, the University of Minnesota and our colleagues in the EMS world, from North Memorial to St. Paul Fire to Health East, now M Health Fairview, Alaina in Hennepin County, has Edina Fire as well. In all the smaller EMS systems that basically deliver patients within the greater metropolitan area of Minneapolis-St. Paul, have decided in about beginning of 2015 to change effectively how we treat refractory ventricular fibrillation patients. The reason for that was there was evidence that was piling up that was suggesting that these people that don't have the luck to be resuscitated very early on, they usually have a cause that prevents them from having ROSC, return of spontaneous circulation, with standard ACLS. Those causes usually are blocked coronary arteries, or subsequently we found out there is either drug toxicities or other idiopathic problems of channelopathies and electrical problems in the heart. So we came together as a community and we decided to change the ACLS process, where for about three, four years, we implemented this strategy, initially with St. Paul Fire in North Memorial Ambulance Services, where we decided that every patient that failed three shocks in the field would automatically be a load and go patient, where at the time of the third shock, they will activate the ECPR or ECMO team at the University of Minnesota Cardiology Division, which at that point it was myself, and for 2 years straight. And they would basically come 24/7 to the cath lab, where we bypass the emergency departments and will go to the cath lab in order to place somebody on ECMO if needed, if they didn't have pulses at that point, and subsequently look to identify reversible causes and fix them if we could. Which usually about 80% of the time was blocked arteries. Once we did this, we realized that a lot of people were arriving about an hour of CPR after 911 call, and there were the majority of them were ongoing CPR, about 95%, 90% of them were ongoing CPR, and some of them had achieved ROST, but they were unstable, hypotensive, or having recurrent ventricular fibrillation. So most of these patients were placed on ECMO, unless at the initial phase before we started, we looked at the blood gases, the ABGs, in order to look for the perfusion state of the patient upon arrival. And we looked at three main components. One was the blood gas for arterial saturation in PO2. And we're looking to find out PO2s that are above 50. Less than 50, we thought they were too far gone. And a lactic acid of less than 18. Which is 18 is a very large number. You very rarely see it in any other scenario besides cardiac arrest. And the third one was not a blood gas, but a physiological marker of some perfusion, which was the end-tile CO2 of less than 10 millimeters of mercury, which is also a sign of very, very poor blood flow through the lungs. So if these patients didn't have any of these criteria, they would be placed on ECMO and subsequently have an angiogram, angioplasty, and then be admitted to the ICU. Over the period of 3-4 years that we did this before we did the RS trial, we realized that those patients that they were receiving the majority of them CPR for up to an hour or sometimes longer, about 30 to 40% or 45% sometimes, depending on the periods that we looked at, they would be alive. And we realized that in the United States and probably the rest of the world, people very rarely receive CPR for an hour or longer unless, you know, there was a reason to do that. So all of these people would have been considered dead or be left to die before the arrival to the ECMO team. So because of that and because of questions about is this really a selection process? Are you selecting people and you're saying you're doing a great job? Or is it really a true effect? We decided to do the only thing that can persuade people, which is a randomized trial. Upon arrival to the emergency department, people were basically have to be randomized to what we do versus what the rest of the world did. And that was the prelude of applying to the National Institute of Health to do this trial.
Now, I know the Minneapolis-St. Paul, you guys were early adopters of mechanical CPR years ago. I'm just curious, like, you wouldn't be able to do really what you're doing if it wasn't for mechanical CPR. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. I think that one of the key characteristics of our EMS community here is the open-minded EMS directors, the ability to collaborate. And the most important thing is the understanding that technology is our friend, not really an enemy to improving outcomes from this very complicated patient. So we did have, and we still have, one of the largest fleets of EMS ambulances and crews that they are equipped with automated CPR devices, predominantly Lucas device at this point, but some EMSs them have auto pulses as well.
Okay, so that's some great background there. We know about mechanical CPR. We need to do it. Why were you personally a early believer of ECMO? Because I will tell you, across the country, you don't really find that. I'm from the Portland, Oregon metropolitan area. We have a lot. We have a couple level one trauma centers. We've got a lot of people that are interested, but they're not quite ready to pull the trigger. And so I guess that's a kind of a two-part question. Why were you such an early believer? And the second part of that is, why do you think it's not more widely accepted as, you know, this is the way we're going. People need to get on board with this.
Well, that's a great question. I think that there are two waves that progress in this field has to fight against. One is the nihilism that existed for years, just because predominantly people that didn't have pulses within 10, 15 minutes, they have a very poor outcome, no matter what people have been doing.
Right.
And that has been diffused into the collective psyche of the medical professionals. So it is, in a way, self-fulfilling prophecies when, you know, you don't believe something can get better, it does not get better, because all these people require a lot of intensive care and therapy and perseverance and training. And if you believe they're dead already, you know, everything that comes along, it's a justification to withdraw support.
Right.
The second thing is the reason I kind of felt that this is the way to go, there are multiple serendipitous kind of events that happened, right? So I had from the get-go when I was 20 years ago, when I was an intern, an interest in hemodynamics and resuscitation. And through my career, starting from basic science, from animals to humans and clinical trials, I realized that the only thing that have ever made a difference in cardiology, in any kind of resuscitation medicine, is the ability to decrease ischemic times, improve blood flow, and deliver more oxygen to tissues during extreme situations. Nothing else really we have tried has really made a difference. If you look at a stroke, we realize, well, early perfusion is great. When you have heart attacks, well, the earlier you open the artery, the better people do and the less damage it happens. And CPR is the same situation in all organs. And therefore, the time that it takes to normalize perfusion is probably the most critical component, because CPR by itself is a declining proposition as far as return to the investment. Yeah. What I mean about that is the blood flow that's generated with CPR deteriorates over time and becomes abysmal after 20 minutes or 30 minutes. Mm. So you need something else if you are to... On the other hand, we know from the military that, you know, even in extreme hemorrhagic shock situations, people have about an hour where you can maintain some flow, even if it's limited, and then fix the patient, and then these people survive. So the human body has the ability to maintain, to sustain extreme insult as long as it does not really go above 60 minutes in general. It's not a, you know, an absolute time point, but it seems that after 60 minutes, things tend to get worse and less likely to survive hemorrhagic shock, cardiac arrest, trauma, you know, cardiogenic shock that is extreme, and hypotension, which is extreme. And that is the reason that I was an early believer of ECMO, not because ECMO is something magical, it's because it takes the whole heart and lung part of the resuscitation effort out of the equation, guarantees what it needs to be guaranteed for the brain and the rest of the organs, including the heart and the lungs, to recover without having to worry about this. And it's not even, you know, the trial was really not even about questioning if ECMO works, because ECMO works. It's, you know, it does what it's supposed to do, right? But it was, how do you identify a patient population that is healthy enough to benefit from that? And how do you deploy this early enough? That's why we had all this effort to do this very efficiently at the same, like by the same team, as fast as possible in order to save time of prolonged low flow states that are detrimental to recovery.
Did you have something, Eric, you were going to say there?
Well, no, I was just going to start in with with looking at the paper itself or looking at the study. It looks like your primary outcome was simple, right? Survival to hospital discharge. The thing I love about it is your secondary outcome was functional assessment at 3 months and 6 months after discharge. Obviously, that is something that is tremendous to be able to evaluate that 3 to 6 months and having neurologically intact people out there walking the streets. Was there any initial other thoughts for your primary secondary outcome, or was that your hypothesis starting out?
We planned this study with a large effect because we really thought from the beginning that it would not go that far. So the initial study design was aiming at 35% survival rate versus 12% survival rate. And the 12% survival rate was really an out overreach, and the 35% was kind of a realistic, I think, based on our 3 year experience prior to that. We didn't want to do a 6 month outcome because I wasn't very certain that we would ever reach a lot of people in the control group at 6 months, because I didn't believe there would be any. And as I was supposedly thinking, I was apparently correct about it, because then you cannot really do your primary endpoint, and it will be limited by the fact that people don't survive to hospital discharge. And so I thought that would be a much more relevant situation, although people would want to know what happens with the, how do you call it, the prolonged resuscitation, so prolonged recovery periods of 6 months or so. And so it was interesting to see that most of the people wanted to know how the people do. But we knew, and we currently know with more than 350 patients we've done over the last 5 years, that the people that survived the hospital discharge in a predominant fashion, more than 90% survived to, you know, as we have longer outcomes of 5.5 years now, these people are all alive. We have lost very few people, mostly drug-related overdoses that we saved, but any cardiac-related arrests, they are all alive.
Again, we're talking the actual study was Advanced Reperfusion Strategies for Patients with Out-of-Hospital Cardiac Arrest and Refractory Ventricular Fibrillation, a phase 2 single center open label randomized controlled trial. So if you're trying to Google the arrest trial, you may not find it, but if you put that in there, you will get that there. So that's wonderful. I'm really interested about, so this was a EFIC study, right? Did you have any issues with informed consent after people were enrolled? Did you have to disenroll anybody, or how did that process go? Because I know those can always be tricky. We've been involved in a number of EFIC studies over the years in our system, and boy, it can be challenging sometimes.
We had the statistical obligation to every 30 days look at the outcomes, and because we did what is called an adaptive design trial, the statisticians in the NHLBI would evaluate the outcomes, and they would start putting more patients in the group that would appear to have a benefit.
Okay.
In order, because the stakes are high, right? It's a death or being alive. The idea was we will try to get the information that we need with a fewer number of patients exposed to the higher risk. And that is the whole idea of adaptive trial designs, and there's a very established way of doing this. We had 30 patients that we had to evaluate the primary endpoints, which is if they're alive at hospital discharge, and then the statisticians will communicate with the NHLBI, and if, you know, they thought that the patients, the outcomes were, you know, legitimate, they would basically have to rearrange the weight of the randomization from 1-1 that was in the first 30 patients to up to 3-1 based on the observed benefit. So you could have a randomization where 3 patients were in the ACLS group versus 1 in the ECMO group if ACLS was substantially better.
I got you. Okay.
Right? Or vice versa. It didn't right. have to be the ECMO group. It's whatever group was better would get more patients. At the same time, though, when you do that, we had the first time where we evaluated the probability of the survival observed meeting the pre-specified stopping criteria, meaning that 30 patients, you had to look at what we call posterior probability, which is effectively like a p-value that most people know, that a threshold above which you cannot continue. It was basically a probability of 98.6% that what you observe is true, not matter of chance. And so our results at that point was that 43% of people with the ECMO trigger group were alive and discharged versus 1 out of the 15 or 6.7%. And that probability was more than 98.6, which was the threshold for the DSMB to give us an official recommendation if they're willing to consider further randomizing or stopping the trial. And because of that, we basically were... the DSMB recommended to NIH that the study should stop because of a significant risk for the control group. And there was a better therapy available for them, effectively. And the NIH recommended ordered us to basically stop the study after their statisticians looked at the data as well. Wow. And at that point, the trials was stopped.
I've been in a number of studies where it went the other way, right? Where it seemed futile and there was seemingly no benefit. And so, you know, we stopped early. One of them I can think of off the top of my head was a hypertonic saline and traumatic brain injury pre-hospital. There didn't seem to be any bang for the buck there. So we stopped that one early. But yeah, that's just really phenomenal.
I think it's phenomenal to say that for all a sample size of 30 patients.
Yeah.
Like that is a big thing.
So yeah, there's a few comments I want to make on this. It's like, you know, people say, well, this is a small study. Well, you know, the size of the study reflects the size of the effect. It's inversely proportional. And, you can't really continue to do something when you know that you're undermining people to die. And it became kind of obvious to us after a point that, you know, based on what we already knew from 4 years of doing this, plus the randomization, that, you know, it became very difficult for us to say we still have equipoise, which is the baseline for any trial to be observed right. And continued. You can't really continue randomize people to the death when you know they have something just to get a bigger trial. And I think people struggle with this because, you know, they're seeing cardiology trials with 50,000 patients or cardiac arrest patients with 100,000 patients. But that is because everybody's looking to find a 0.5% improvement in survival, not an absolute of, 35% survival that we find, or 37, whatever it was. Yeah. That means that, we had to treat 2.5 patients to see a patient alive compared to standard care.
That's outstanding.
Yeah, that is amazing. That number needed to treat, like, holy mackerel.
Yeah, there's not a lot of things that do that, right? I mean,
I can think of like AEDs or, bystander CPR maybe, but yeah, there's not a lot of things.
Yeah, I don't even know. Yes, you're correct. And I'm not going to get into this, how much is each one of them. Right. All of them are important. But yeah, it is very large effect. And then what was even more profound was that the fact that the only patient that survived really was, in the control group of neurological damage. And then at 2.5 months, there was no one alive, whereas all the other people were walking and having almost normal lives, or some of them complete normal lives. One is still a biased, I don't know if I can say that, but it's like it's functional, right. Back to his work and doing work, and the other one is retired, the other one is biking every day. I mean, these are functional people compared to death and neurological devastation. So, and this is the other thing I was also important is that the control group that we published is in absolute concordance with anything that has been published from any country or any EMS system for people that have CPR more than 40 minutes. No one survives. Yeah. And people have these anecdotes that, oh, yeah, but what about this? Yes, we all have one patient that survived 1.5 hour with CPR, but this is 1 out of, 50,000. And yeah. And the other thing is the ECMO results were very consistent with our prior results and current results, which is in the range of 35 to 40 something percent of people surviving. And so it was consistent. The trial was very consistent. And I would recommend for you to find the paper that is a dual paper. It was published at the same time at with the first author being Bartos in eClinical Medicine. It's actually referenced in the Lancet paper that responds to the community implementation of this program. And we were able to have the same exact survival rate in a parallel program that we implemented during that time.
Yeah, so that we do have that paper. And for the listeners, it's called the Minnesota Mobile ECMO Resuscitation Consortium for Treatment of Out-of-Hospital Refractory Ventricular Fibrillation. Program description, performance outcomes, and we will put this in the show notes. I do have a few added questions that I'm sure our listeners are gonna ask. I know you do have a mobile ECMO team. Can you talk about that design? Really, the how that's set up and how they function within the capacity of University of Minnesota and under guidance of you. And then, you know, what you're seeing is the future.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the, again, context is very important here. While we were doing all this, we realized that obviously ECMO effect on survival is very close, closely correlated with time to ECMO. So, and also because of that effect, our ability to reach out to a larger percentage of the state population was limited because of transport times. So our goal was to try to affect more people, catch more patients within a time frame of 911 call to about 45 minutes to 55 minutes, no more than that. And our ultimate goal is to be within half an hour to 45 minutes, but that's going to be complicated and requires a lot more reorganization than we currently can report that we have. So what we decided to do is basically all of this was facilitated by highly supportive in pioneer thinking by the Helmsley Charitable Trust. And they were, and they are still, our support for this endeavor to show what can be done and how can be done and develop the blueprints that other communities can follow in order to make this implementation broad in the United States. So what we said is, okay, there are a few characteristics of these patients and the management of the patients that are paramount in the success for the program, of the program. So what we think is, number one, these patients are, although are a lot, they are infrequent for each EMS provider and each doctor in the lives of the, you know, of our shifts and our responses. Each one of us sees a few of these patients because we have a large, much larger workforce, both in EMS and the physicians that treat these cases.
Yeah.
So the thesis that I have is that you have to have a concentrated team that does a lot of them to be able to have the expertise and the know-how and develop the science that currently does not exist in the upcoming years in order to treat these people more efficiently. You also need this team to be standby, cannot be doing something else, seeing patients in clinic or, you know, doing this and that, because it's such a time-sensitive emergency that the response needs to be immediate, something similar to being in a, you know, fire team or a police team or any kind of EMS agency team that have to respond within a few minutes. Now, that model does not exist in the United States. There's no physicians that are standby to go out and do this on a, you know, 10-minute note. So we had to build all this from scratch, and we actually did. What we did was that we created a team that is includes about 10 physicians in about 12 or 15 flight nurses from LifeLink 3. We are housed in the center of the city inside the University of Minnesota Center for Gestation Medicine. And we have a dispatch process where every EMS provider that identifies a patient capable meeting some of the criteria, meaning they have shockable rhythms and they have failed one or two shocks, they call through LifeLink dispatch where either, if they're clear-cut case, we are dispatched immediately to meet them at the closest hospital participates, or they patch us through in order to give more get more clarifications for the patients from the medics on the scene. And the thing that the way that we made this work, and you know, long-term and sustainability, all of those things need to be determined yet, was that the team that we created is shared by all the healthcare systems that participate. And currently we have four healthcare systems that participate. So the doctors, they come from different healthcare systems, but during that time, whenever they operate in a hospital of a different healthcare system, they have credentials and they operate under the you know, the billing codes for that healthcare system. So that took away the competition concept between healthcare systems. And it's like, you know, a team that goes around and can operate in all the emergency departments for now, where the team arrives within 10, 12 minutes from the 911 call. And we pay for the time of the physicians, back their own institutions to pay to buy their time effectively, and we build the systems for the services we provide, and basically it's a pass through. We pay back the systems for the time, and we build them for the services. And it's a nonprofit organization we build. It's called the Minnesota Mobile Resuscitation Consortium, or MMRC. That MMRC has a board with members on the board being representative from each healthcare system that participates. And we have a medical director, an operation director, and we also have an EMS board that is basically part of this process, because the most important thing is collaboration with EMS agencies and providers. So it is kind of complicated, and I can't even start to express my frustration of the legal documents I had to sign and see in order for this to happen. But the reality is that it happened, and we will see. Unfortunately, you know, the operation started about 4 months before COVID. Then we stopped for 4 months. Then we restarted for 2 months. The COVID stopped us to our tracks again. So currently, We are not operational, but we only have the ability to receive patients the old way at the university, where we kept that process going. The reason was that the hospital bed capacity was not allowing for us to have consistent openings, you know, services. And we are planning to start again, assuming that COVID is going to be under control again, March or April of this year. And now hopefully after that, we will never shut down.
Well, I'll tell you what, from what I'm hearing, just, you know, congratulations to you, every system that's worked with you. I mean, this is true systems of care. Like, it's absolutely just phenomenal.
Yeah, I think the most important thing here is that there is some collaboration that it's actually surprised me too. But I think there are two things. I think people realize that this patient population is not a large patient population. It can be expanded, but the number of people that actually need and benefit from this is small. Right. The cost for each hospital to have a service like this, it's extraordinary. Imagine having interventional cardiologists, ED docs, radiologists, nurses that are specifically trained for this 24/7 in each hospital, yeah, to get a patient every 3-4 days in a city like this. It's not feasible. The cost would be, it's basically multiplied. But if you share the team, the cost is shared, and it's much more palatable, and the outcomes of these patients are significantly better than the alternative, which leads to an additional incentive for communities to come together. The other thing is that everybody realizes that the expertise in the medical specialties that are required for this program to be successful are not currently available. There is no specialty that deals holistically with these patients like any other situation. So, you know, you probably know, I mean, you know, that before we had trauma centers and trauma surgeons, you know, general surgeons were doing trauma. Right. And then, right, you know, we had neurosurgeons doing some brain-related stuff. But then you could develop a trauma team, and a neurosurgeon is part of that team. And so effectively, trauma and burn and, you know, resuscitation will be, I think, subspecialties of different, you know, physicians and nursing staff that require to have a lot of knowledge. And that's what we're trying to develop. And this is one of the biggest questions that NIH had, and then what, right? So we are in the process of trying to define a national policy of how do you move along with this process. I am not really a believer into saying, oh, I need another bigger trial. It's like there will be another trial coming from Europe shortly. Hopefully the results will be positive. And that is also, it's a little bigger trial, looks at 6 months outcomes from Czech Republic. And you know, it is a trial that will help this cause. But it's not really anymore if ECMO works, but how do you make your system make ECMO work? And that is a fundamental difference between a randomized trial and an implementation process and training process. And I would put forward to you and your listeners the idea that we never have had a trial for transplantation or left ventricular assist devices or bypass surgery, as far as I'm concerned, as far as pragmatic trial of bypass surgery. Can you imagine having a bypass trial with people that are not trained in surgery, cardiac surgery? If you and I were trying to do cardiac surgery in a randomized trial, how do you think the outcomes of these patients would be?
For the ones you worked on, maybe a little better than the one Eric and I worked on. But yeah, you're right. Exactly.
Right. So this is the idea that people are struggling because they always have this, I call it the candy that they have in the mouth. Always, whenever they don't know anything else to say, they say, well, but we need a multi-center randomized trial to verify the results. So, okay, you can go verify. But for example, in Minnesota, you know, I had these discussions. We don't have the ethical ability to randomize people anymore. It's basically in our capabilities, in our infrastructure, it's not ethical to randomize somebody in control if we have this available. So randomized trials are maybe a way to do it if systems try to develop this in the United States and they start seeing that, you know, the results are not that much better than standard CPR. And that is, if that's the case, then they might need a randomized trial to dispute the results in their communities. But it's hard to argue when you have somebody, you know, in CPR for 75 minutes, you put them on ECMO, you have to pronounce him dead, and then they can walk the hospital out of the hospital about a month later. And you say, well, there's the end of one. The patient I would have pronounced dead at that point. And I was walking. I don't need a trial for that, right?
It's I just have one last question, and we'll try to get you out of here. Again, thanks so much for coming on here. But are there any secondary studies you're looking forward to coming from your data?
Yes, we have a lot actually that is coming out, and I think it'll be very useful. The most important is the combination of long-term outcomes, both from people that survived the trial here, which are not a lot, but also from our cohort of about 300 patients that we have, or 350, I don't remember where we are now, but over the 5 years, so we'll compare the cost of those patients, caring for these patients, with the National Registry for Transplants and VADs, and average survival rate over a five-year period for these cohorts. And I would tell you that what is not expected is that this population that we're talking about, the ECPR population, it appears to have, if not the same, even higher survival rates over 5 years compared to this highly specialized, expensive, and long-term care and cost-related devices and operations. So, you know, somebody with an ECPR process, the cost for surviving the hospital is not insignificant. It's it's in the range of a left ventricular assist device. But these people, in general, because the people have neurological damage do not survive the hospital discharge, the ones that survive, they survive and they do well. And their follow-up and the cost of their care subsequently much less than people that are immunocompromised or have a wire coming out of their chest because of the VAD and the device failures and hospitalizations. They are basically back to normal and they live 5 years with a higher chance of survival than the other groups. And for me, that is what was going to change the field, because currently we're still struggling with the idea, well, but these are dead people. But now the problem is that it's not. And the average age of this population is mid-50s. So mid-50s is not, I'm not that far from there. And I don't think that it's like, you know, futility there. I have a few more years. So that's where we are.
Well, we really, really appreciate all your ability to change practice. I mean, I think this is definitely groundbreaking. I think the data is exciting. You know, like I said, the sample size being 30, and I think you said it perfectly, you know, that really doesn't mean anything. It's about the effect, and that the trial was stopped early because of the control group and the numbers that see in this study is phenomenal. So, I think, for purposes of just the explanation of this study, I think we've really hit everything. Really, really appreciate you taking the time. I know it was hard for us to connect with you. You're a very busy man. And on behalf of everybody at Flatbridge Ed, we really appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much for the invitation. I hope that we will have more good information coming out soon so people start restructuring their responses for these patients that I think they are going to have much better outcomes in the future. Thank you for the invitation, because it's important for the message to go out, especially for people that they are caring for those patients, and medics and flight nurses and everybody. They very rarely hear the results of their actions and the outcomes of those patients, and I think that's important for them to know.
Great. Well, on behalf of Dr. Yiannopoulos, Eric Bauer, Mike Verkest, you've been listening to the Flightbridge Ed podcast, the flagship member of the Flightbridge Ed podcast network, and we appreciate you guys listening. Take care and have a great day.
This has been a production of the Flightbridge Ed podcast, leading the way in pre-hospital critical care and emergency medicine education.